Hello, this is The New World, a podcast produced by Reaction, exploring the world after the coronavirus crisis. I'm Jack Dickens, International Editor at Reaction. The rise of China continues to transform global politics. And under President Xi Jinping, the country seeks to project its power both at home and abroad. But this meteoric rise has now brought a sharp backlash from the United States. Since Donald Trump's entry into the White House, a trade war has been ignited between Washington and Beijing, and the coronavirus pandemic has now further catalyzed a turn away from constructive engagement and towards strategic rivalry between the two countries. So, what is the future of Sino-American relations? And is the coronavirus crisis a turning point in world history? With me to discuss these questions on the podcast today is Bruno Massaes, fellow at the Hudson Institute and author of The Dawn of Eurasia. Hello, Bruno. Thank you very much for coming onto the podcast today. How should we think about the rivalry between the United States of America and the People's Republic of China, both in geopolitical terms and as a moment in history?
I think the question, the main question is, are we entering a new Cold War? Is there something in the current situation that reminds us of the Cold War between the West, the United States, and the Soviet Union? I think there's a debate on this to some extent. It's about terminology. What should we call a Cold War? I think we can all agree that we're entering a different period in relations between US and China, much more confrontational. But I don't think that's either particularly surprising or new. Great powers, when they approach each other in power, tend to compete. That's been the case all over history, even in periods where you don't have the same phenomenon of globalization. And so a certain overlapping of base and influence, which of course contributes to this. So For the time being, I would focus on the idea of great power competition. Now, whether it is a Cold War depends on how we define a Cold War and whether the concept can be useful to define a particular set of cases, which is what I would tend to do. I wouldn't use Cold War, as I think some commentators use, to refer to every case of great power competition. I wouldn't talk about a Cold War between the Persian Empire and the Roman Empire. I think we use it for one specific case and perhaps for other cases that have a lot in common with that specific case, and we have to see whether this one has it. I don't think it does, not quite yet.
Yes, and do you think the problem with calling the rivalry between the US and China a Cold War is that we're stuck to a certain extent in older mentalities when the world has changed quite a lot since the Berlin Wall fell down? And one of the ideas you explore a lot in your book, The Dawn of Eurasia, is that we have a much more multipolar world now. We're far more connected geopolitically and economically. And so do you think we need to change how we think about confrontations on the global level altogether?
Right. I do think so. I think we have some substantively new elements in world politics today. I think the multipolar element is important. And when that goes together with integration, with economic integration, with global integration, it is, as I say in the book, a situation that might actually be entirely novel, entirely new. We've had a global integration with British hegemony or American hegemony. We had multipolar worlds in the past, but they tended to be based on almost a theory of separate individualized universes. China and the Habsburg Empire had very little interaction. So what we have today with different poles, we'll see what the final shape is, but could be four, five, six sovereign poles of power in world politics. But they all sharing a space that feels, from the point of view of decision makers, feels rather limited. It seems to be shrinking, actually. Then it's a substantively new situation.
So there are clearly new elements, but there seems to be another implicit argument in some of your work, which is that from another perspective, we're heading back to something a little bit older in terms of we're not looking at a world where the transatlantic highway is now the main point for economic contestation. Mm. It's now back to the areas where the old Silk Roads used to shape the global economy. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Right. I think we're going back to a form of Eurasian geopolitics, going back to the idea that this supercontinent from Lisbon to Shanghai, from Lisbon to Jakarta, is almost by nature the center of world power. And even an outside actor has to become an actor in Eurasia, as the United States has been since it's been a world power, since the turn of the century from the 19th to the 20th century. I think American global power really started contemporaneously with American presence and intervention in the China question right at the turn of the century. So those two things go together, and I expect the United States to do the same now. If you look at it, only the actors have changed, but the fundamental principle of American policy has been for 120 years to prevent one single actor from controlling the whole of Eurasia. Not the whole of Europe, but the whole of Eurasia. There was a concern at the turn of the century with Germany. Perhaps Germany, in a kind of informal alliance with Russia, would take over control of China, seen as a source of natural resources. This is talked about by American strategists around 1900. It was in Germany during World War II. It was then Soviet Union center in Russia during the Cold War, and now China. But the question is always the same. Is this power strong enough to take control, even if indirect and informal, over the whole of Eurasia? And if it does, then that will mean trouble. That will spell trouble for the United States. So the principle remains the same. It's just now, in 120 years, China has moved from a kind of territory that great powers battle over into actually the actor that creates the problem for America.
So thinking of China's role as a fully fledged Eurasian actor on the chessboard, right, you like to talk about, what is the significance of the Belt and Road Initiative, and how should we think about it? You know, what vocabulary should we use?
I've been arguing, and I think it's more plausible today than when I published my book, that the Belt and Road is really a geopolitical project that goes much beyond infrastructure. It's about overturning the existing political and economic order, replacing it with something else. This is done through a number of instruments, in particular economic value chains, which has been the secret of Chinese power for 40 years already, and I think there's continuity there. Those value chains are now becoming transnational, and they are becoming obviously a source of great power for China. The Chinese markets and Chinese value chains, but you can see now almost every day in the news instances where China can use that economic power, the way it has become the center of important value chains, and the way in which it has become such an important market that, for example, Volkswagen in Germany exports more than 40% of its vehicles to the Chinese market. And I think that helps explain a lot of things. Clearly, if one day Chinese authorities decide to close off its market to Volkswagen, then I don't know if Volkswagen can survive. It's already in trouble. So these questions are obviously at the forefront now. And the Belt and Road is about this. It's about expanding that source of economic power, which then goes with politics. Because as the Volkswagen example shows, if you have that kind of economic power, it is by definition also political power. You can make governments think twice or be inclined to take decisions in your favor without much difficulty.
And do you think we've seen this sort of bearing fruit in China's recent foreign policy endeavors in terms of the new national security law in Hong Kong? A lot of the countries who sided with China in the Human Rights Council of the UN were also members of the Belt and Road. And is what you're essentially saying that forget the full economic vision of this thing, it's really going to be an important political weapon?
Right, it will. Now, those countries, it is true that, you know, China is accused frequently of not having any allies, which is true in some sense, but they don't seem interested in having the kind of allies that the US has had. They're not moving in and trying to scoop some of those countries. They seem more interested in economic network where they can exercise leverage and power than a formal structure of alliance. Now, despite of that, they can get a number of countries, often 50, 60 countries in the world, to sign statements in their favor, sometimes on topics that you would think at first it would be difficult. Large parts of the Muslim world have signed statements on Xinjiang, for example. That has to do with economic power. Now, what you could say, and I think it's relevant, has to be said, is that those countries, if you look carefully, if you add their GDP, you'll find that perhaps they add up to 5% of global GDP. So they are poor countries, and in some cases, small countries. But that is a process that is evolving, and you have to remember the Belt and Road is only 7 years old. Clearly, if it continues in the same direction, then a decade or two from now, you could see already some major countries acting in the same way and being part of what you could call a Chinese sphere of influence. Obviously, Italy signed a memorandum on the Belt and Road. Sometimes signing a piece of paper is not so significant, but you can see that there's a a certain movement forward, which before the pandemic was actually quite fast.
Do you think in some senses there's a danger of overemphasizing the power of the Belt and Road as it is at the moment as well? Because obviously this has created some pushback from some of the recipient governments in Maldives, in Malaysia, in Africa as well, because of the debts which it incurs and the debts owed to China. And is it possible that this has the opposite effect to that intended, and it actually ends up pushing some governments towards the IMF and the Western sphere of influence again?
Many of these countries have no alternative, and world politics is what it is. It is about power anyway. These countries are organized also about kind of a ruthless understanding of power in their domestic politics. So it is not like they will recoil in horror from the fact that, that China can exercise power. It's also the story of American power. Again, going back to 1900, America wasn't welcome all over the world as a beacon of freedom in many cases. There was a resistance and pushback, and many books being published, even in Europe around 1900. One in particular that I discuss in my new book had the title American Invaders. And this was a phenomenon quite common in Europe at the time. That's where you go back to find the roots of anti-Americanism. So I think Chinese are realistic enough to understand that you cannot overturn the world's economic and political order without breaking some eggs. I think it's what's going to happen. And we're seeing it particularly after the pandemic with a much more aggressive foreign policy.
I'm glad you mentioned some of the symmetries between the US and China that perhaps some people aren't exploring. And I'd really like to come back to that later. So I'm sure you've come across this. Francis Fukuyama has written a recent essay in The American Interest saying that China has moved away from being a regular kind of authoritarian power to a more totalitarian state. And as someone who's spoken a lot with Chinese officials, I want to ask you, is that the best way of thinking about it? Or is that in a kind of trap of thinking about these things in a Western liberal tradition?
There's a certain phenomenon in the West now where somehow commentators who haven't, as far as I know, ever lived in China are caught up in this spiral where you have to show your credentials as a Cold Warrior. This happened during the Cold War, seems to be happening actually more now. We also need analysis and some aspects of Chinese life are being quite obscured in the West. That's actually not even a good thing if you think about the long-term confrontation. I thought there was a much better effort during the initial stages of the Cold War to understand the Soviet Union. And today, unfortunately, I don't see any canon around that can do that, because probably whoever canon is available will have to join this chorus. Now, a totalitarian society, I don't know what concept Fukuyama is operating under, but my sort of textbook definition of totalitarianism, of totalitarian regime, is a regime where there's no space whatsoever for society, where the state occupies every nook and cranny. Now, that's not true of Chinese society. In the places where the state encourages it, there is a lot of space for human initiative, let us say in the technology sector, which often takes place entirely outside the view of the state or state intervention. It's encouraged because it's considered to be an element of Chinese power. So there is a nationalistic element to it. Not having lived in the Soviet Union, I cannot make a comparison, but clearly it doesn't seem to me to correspond to the model of a totalitarian society. And by this, I don't mean any kind of praise. I just mean that we have to also leave some room for political science, for objective analysis.
And I'm going to stray into counterfactuals now, which can sometimes be fun if perilous. You know, there seems to be a lot of wishing about this. If only China was on the path to liberal democracy, if only Xi Jinping wasn't pursuing a more assertive foreign policy. But do you think it would be the case if China were to become a democracy? Would it not be more like a kind of illiberal democracy that we might see somewhere else in Turkey or Eastern Europe than anything that American policymakers would welcome?
Right. I think that is also a problem with, let us say, this argument that we're expecting for China to become a bit more like us. And in fact, it now has become clear that we're only going to go back to the same kind of relation we had with China if China changes. This is not taken seriously in China. It's not even very clear what that would mean, because, as you say correctly, every kind of democracy we could have in China would not be taken seriously in the West, because it would not look like the kind of Western democracy. And It would always be possible to argue that whatever party was in power, I suppose a communist party would still exist and would win elections that would raise many doubts, and it would be criticized as Turkey is criticized for its human rights record and so on. So in a way, it never quite seems like a very serious path, this path of conversion to a Western model. We've seen difficulties even in the Balkans, where, let us say, the European Union is never quite happy with the kind of democracies that we have there. And that would be obviously a problem if anything like that was ever attempted in China. But there's no interest in that. Incidentally, sometimes there's an attempt to argue that within Xi Jinping things were different. But the Communist Party thinks that the sources of Chinese power come from the non-democratic, non-liberal elements of the Chinese regime, or at the very least, the mix between market and state power. So they are convinced that if they were to change that, Chinese power would suffer. There are many people in the West that genuinely believe that were China to become a democracy, it would become an even more powerful country. It's possible, but that's not how Chinese authorities regard it. So to that extent, they see the two things being complementary, Chinese global power and the shape of the regime as it is today.
Just thinking about some of these differences and similarities possibly between the West and China more generally, it seems to me that what Xi and the Communist Party really want to do is to create a society where the state is harmonious, where it is effective, where it, to a certain extent, precludes the need for there to be any conflict in society that you might see in a liberal democracy. But if you look at the founding of the European community and the European Union, thinkers such as Jean Monnet and Alexander Kojève also had a similar kind of idea in some ways, this idea that we're heading to a Hegelian state that will eliminate the need for socio and economic conflict and manage things according to an enlightened technocracy. And do you think we have the foundations there of a kind of common understanding, or is this always going to drive conflict?
You could argue that. Some people argue that technocracy is what brings China and Europe together. I'm not quite convinced. And first of all, because I don't really regard the Chinese regime as a technocratic regime. It is a revolutionary regime, both in its domestic politics, where it has operated a revolution in the way Chinese people live. It's not a traditional Leninist revolution, but it has been for the past 40 years and before, but the processes have been similar. It's this attempt to uproot Chinese life and build it on a different pattern. And that's the opposite of technocracy. That's a very sovereignist understanding of political power. And then in international politics, as we talked about, I regard the Belt and Road as a revolutionary project, not a technocratic project. And so I think there's obviously elements here that are bound to raise serious problems. I've already raised problems, but more and more serious problems in Europe. What I argue in the book is that we share increasingly the same space, but the models are different. And I don't see any possibility of convergence also here between the European Union, let us say, and China. That doesn't mean that the kind of relations we have between the European Union and China will be similar to the relations between the US and China. I think they will be very different. They will be based on economic competition more than geopolitical competition.
Moving on from technocracy, one thing I would like to ask you about is technology. And, you know, there is this idea which has been advanced by a lot of commentators for the last few decades that China can't be technologically innovative because it is politically authoritarian. But in your book, you really turn this idea on its head and you say that actually, in many ways, it's we in the West who've become technological conservatives. Could you just expand on this?
That takes us back to the question of whether China is a totalitarian society. And those who argue that will have to explain why it has become so dynamic in its technological sector and in technological innovation, which I think is indisputable, particularly if you live in China, where you see how quick technological change happens and how deep and pervasive it is, and how, in fact, on many dimensions, China is now ahead of the West. And that's really indisputable if you know anything about Chinese cities and Chinese life. That obviously requires an element of individual initiative, as I said, requires a lot of investment in universities and technological development. And of course, it was also based on technology transfer, which is actually where you have a clash of views between West and China, because in the West, that is regarded as intellectual property theft. And in China, genuinely, I get the question a lot of from Chinese interlocutors, what is the problem of adopting some of your technology? And this is said not in a facetious way. There's actually genuine difficulty understanding that. I do see some worrisome elements of technological stagnation in the West. That is due to many reasons, but one of them that I think is particularly relevant when we compare to China is the question of whether technology can be an individual endeavor. In Silicon Valley, people seem to believe that it's possible for an individual, one person, Steve Jobs, to change the world. And of course, for people coming from a Marxist tradition, a communist tradition, this is more or less nonsense. And China regards these things more in a societal way. So people are given some space to compete as young entrepreneurs, but then society is behind them. In a way, if you think about an example like self-driving vehicles, I think you see where there's a clash of views. Don't you need authorities to come in to change the shape of our cities, to take on risk, to regulate? That cannot be left to the individual. It's not Elon Musk that is going to change the laws on liability, that is going to change the shape of cities so that they are more welcoming to self-driving cars and so on. So you do need a societal effort, which, of course, will create victims of technological progress. And it's very obvious in China. And this is something that has become also morally repugnant for people in the West, that we don't think people should pay for what is considered societal progress, that in a way the individual comes first. So important questions, but the main thing I think is to stop and think that if this is the framework under which you're going to operate for two or three decades, then it's very likely that China is going to come out on top, because in the end, technology is the source of state power. And you see today more dynamism in China. Now, when I used to argue this 1 or 2 years ago, it was sometimes dismissed, but I think the virus itself has shown some of this, how the United States has struggled, for example, with developing good tests and quickly, that by the end of April, it didn't have nationwide tests. And that's a pretty easy question to solve, but many societies in the West are struggling with this now.
I'm glad you mentioned the United States, because if we could just put China perhaps to one side for a moment and go over to the other Leviathan on the other side of the Pacific. Do you think that the United States is going to come out of the next century of geopolitical tensions as a very changed country? I think one of the fascinating arguments in some of your work revolves around the idea that Trump is not a signal of American decline. It is the start of something new that we're still discovering, and we don't quite know what it will look like yet. So asking you a very broad question again, what do you think this America is going to look like?
Right. So we've been talking about how the world is going to be very different, multipolar world with probably fast technological change. I think there's a certain awareness in the US that the old paradigm is not working on technology as well as just talked about, and on many other things. Also on the way the US relates to the rest of the world, because the neoconservative paradigm is of course impossible to operate on in a multipolar world where power is much more distributed. The idea that the US is going to be a global empire and it's going to be able to actually transform societies in a certain direction has to be replaced with something else, but we don't know exactly what it is. And in my most recent book, I argue that we have to go back to some concept of balance of power, where again, the United States should be making sure that no actor becomes too powerful, but not necessarily interested in shaping the whole world in its image. And Trump does represent this, even if he's not aware of it, and even people around him don't have an explicit and developed foreign policy doctrine. What he has done effectively, for example, with relation to Turkey, is to allow Turkey to actually develop into a counterweight to Russia. So rather than confronting Russia directly in Syria or in Libya, which would be the neoconservative solution, Trump has created a room for Turkey to do that. Turkey has its own interests, which are more often than not in contradiction with Russian interests. And so it seems a better kind of foreign policy to use that, to use the dynamics of balance of power. I think Trump in many respects represents the destruction of the old world, not the creation of a new one. He hasn't been able really to even offer any kind of blueprint or offer credibility in this endeavor, to be honest. But he has done already a lot of work in terms of helping Americans along towards a new way of thinking. I think in a way that has been his contribution. I'm expecting him to lose the election, so it has been his contribution in these 4 years.
So do you think in a certain sense that the Trump revolution will really be making American geopolitical power and how it operates a bit more honest in some ways? Because one of the reasons why liberals and American liberals and Western liberals generally got quite upset about Erdogan in Turkey, it seems, is because they were holding Turkey to the standard of a member of the West and as a member of NATO. And there is a discussion to be had about whether that's correct or not. But I'm pretty sure there must have been voices in Ankara saying, well, actually, the US has been allies with Saudi Arabia for a very long time. And that is a country which pursues certain aggressive intentions and its own interests in its own ways. And why shouldn't we also be able to do this? So will Trump's contribution to a certain extent be a kind of a loosening of this ideological constraints in which American power has been held and allowing something new to develop afterwards, whether it's a Biden presidency or the presidency that comes after Biden?
Exactly. I think there has to be an effort to think of the world as being composed of different actors, thinking of a pattern of interaction between these different actors that you are happy with, and trying to move things in that direction, but not necessarily assuming that you are the only actor. Because remember, we sometimes use the image of a chess game to talk about world politics, but clearly the neoconservative imagination was a chess game with only one player. And this is counterproductive for American interests themselves, because obviously what happened in the case of Turkey was that by considering Turkey no more than a proxy or a sort of under American direct command and serving American interests and really not having interests of its own, particularly on the question of the PKK. And in a way, you know, Turkey regards PKK as a terrorist organization. The US, even though it has classified it as a terrorist organization, seems to think differently. But it is odd that the US expects Turkey to subscribe to the view in Washington on a matter that affects Turkey and not Washington. But I think this is the sort of excesses that American foreign policy has been led into and that are counterproductive, because the result under Obama was that Turkey moved away from the US and became a counterweight to American power, rather than, as happened under Trump, a counterweight to Russian power, which seems better from the point of view of American interests.
And also, you know, it comes back to that age-old divide of idealism and realism. And really what America needs to find perhaps is a better middle way. And, you know, could this middle way, you know, if we've, again, we've come back to this kind of strange dialectic, you know, it might be something new, but it also might be something older again. Could this new United States foreign policy really be a kind of reversion to the norm before the Truman Doctrine, before the Second World War, to something which Franklin Delano Roosevelt described as unentangled and free, making sure that there is no dominant hegemonic power in Eurasia, but seeing that as the means to defend American freedom, not this activist foreign policy which creates more problems than it resolves?
Yeah, yes, I agree with that. You know, the Truman Doctrine, I discussed it in my most recent book. It probably was meant differently at the beginning. Clearly, Truman himself had no intention of intervening anywhere in the world anytime one democracy was in any kind of trouble, even domestic, as the doctrine defended. And what happened, of course, immediately after Truman defended that idea was that the United States had to help many countries that were not democratic. So in violation of the doctrine. I think Truman and the people around him expounded the doctrine in those very ambitious terms as a way to send a message to Stalin. Then later, the doctrine was interpreted more or less literally. And that took us to Vietnam, and then took us even to the excesses of neoconservatism in Iraq. I think it's time now for a correction and go back perhaps to an older way of thinking of these things. At least formally, it's an older way, because it accepts the existence of different poles of power and different political models. Now, there's no reason the U.S. cannot remain the global superpower in the sense that it's the balancer, in the sense that it is the actor that is making sure no other actor becomes too powerful. But it can only be the balancer if it assumes its role as a balancer. which it hasn't so far. That's, I guess, the question for the next president and perhaps the president after Biden.
What I'm wondering is this U.S. pivot away from being this neoconservative power with a homogenized view of the world, will this also change the American idea of liberty as well? Because it seems to me that after the Second World War and during the Cold War, the US intervened actively economically with the Marshall Plan in Europe. It developed a theory of universal human rights to challenge the universal revolution of the communists in Soviet Russia. But as the US perhaps drifts away from Europe and goes more towards India and the Indo-Pacific, allies such as Japan, will this also change the American ideal of freedom? Will it become something much more utilitarian, something which is viewed as a way to create wealth and prosperity, but also ensure that it acts as a counterweight against the ideology of the Communist Party in China? Will it become something more limited, or will it become something even larger, perhaps something religious, and to win over countries such as India? What do you think about this?
I've been thinking a lot about that and writing about that. I think the concept of freedom in America is already very different from the concept of freedom in the liberal tradition, or the concept of freedom that is still dominant in Europe. But I would call it, as you were saying at the end of your question, I would call it a kind of hyper-freedom, not a utilitarian limited freedom, but a kind of excessive limitless freedom, in the sense that even reality disappears, even facts disappear because they are an obstacle to freedom. What we have in America today is a clash of almost storylines, Hollywood storylines. There's a permanent attempt to create alternate realities, a permanent attempt to create a fantasy life on Trump's side. But then wokeness is also an example of this. Political life has become extraordinarily theatrical, fictional. We live in a world of permanent conspiracies and plots and spy stories of one kind or another, the deep state. Even when a virus strikes, the discussion is still about this kind of narratives and this kind of fictional structures. And the virus itself kind of disappears and becomes rather irrelevant. That's what is extraordinary in America these days, is that the pandemic is raging, but people are obsessed about a letter that was written for a magazine supporting free speech, or they are obsessed whether Trump is wearing a mask or not wearing a mask. So I see American life has acquired these characteristics, which in a way move it beyond the European tradition and the Enlightenment model into something different, which then hopefully can translate into a new way of thinking about world politics and a new way of thinking about the world, where the United States actually is much more open to the existence of diverse ways of life, because it is also attracted by the possibility of a world full of different life forms, full of different stories of different content. America more open to the world, more curious about the world, more interested in its inherent exoticism. One of the problems, perhaps even the main problem with neoconservatism, was the way it made the world poorer, because it interpreted everything in terms of what is immediate to you. It interpreted everything in terms of your own way of life. So I'm hoping for a different kind of American politics that tries to make this concept of hyper-freedom work, because the crisis today in America is not a crisis of exhaustion where people are, in a way, tired of life. It is the opposite. There is too much energy, and there are too many excesses of imagination and of ambition. And you have to create a new political model and new political structures to make this work. This concept of hyper-freedom probably will need some changes in American society. Right now, you can see American society buckling under the weight of different concepts that it doesn't quite know how to manage, and that are difficult to manage by definition, because they are excessive.
And thinking about a country such as India, another vast landmass, or one of America's allies in the Pacific, like South Korea or Japan, how do these countries think about their own democratic systems? And how do they think about freedom? Because it, as far as I've read, it's not quite the same as the universal tradition of Enlightenment human rights, is it?
No. And, you know, I think we're realizing that what we thought was universal is not really universal. When we talk about freedom, we talk about the possibility of allowing your life patterns to develop, to grow. But those life patterns are different. the things people are interested in, the way they understand the world is very different in India, Japan, or the United States. And then never forget that we have become, I think this is a perhaps a point where we have become political scientists and we shouldn't. Never forget that things are never so clear. Every regime has elements of freedom and elements of authority. And you can even go to regimes you might think are dictatorial and find in that society, if you give yourself the time to look around, to stay and to look around, you'll find many places where people live free. Could be their family life, could there be the traditions. So never assume that it's very clear to distinguish between this is the group of the free countries and that's the group of the unfree countries, which is again very reductive way in which we lately, over the past few decades, have started thinking about these things. We need to recover the tradition of actually understanding countries on their own terms. And we did a better job with that, actually at a time where you wouldn't expect it. European imperialism, in a way, made more of an effort to understand distant cultures than 20th century liberalism did. We sometimes talk about, let us say, Kipling or Macaulay as imperialists, but you go read their books on India and you just don't see anyone today that could even come close to this in terms of understanding a different culture and wanting to understand a different culture. So again, I'm hoping for the positive consequences of a multipolar world also here, that if we are forced to understand the world on its own terms, because the rest of the world is powerful enough to ask that from us, that's not a bad thing. The problem of having too much power is that you lose interest in other people. And I think the West in particular has suffered from that. And then, of course, if you lose interest in other people, your own societies become less creative and become less open. And eventually, your own power will suffer, thereby leading to a multipolar world where perhaps your interest in the rest of the world will be recovered and the cycle repeats itself.
And you know, that's perhaps one of the interesting paradoxes in the period after the Cold War, of the period of hyper-globalization and faith in liberal democracy, this idea that actually diversity is important in our own countries and in our own elections, but we want the whole world to be the same. And that works in reverse too, obviously, with countries such as Russia or China, who want a kind of democratic system of global governance, but an autocratic state in their own countries. So finally, Bruno, we've explored a lot of these differences, and I wondered whether we could also look at the symmetries we touched on earlier in the podcast. And thinking about the symmetries between the US and China, is there something similar in the sort of the spirit of these two countries? You know, they're both these vast land masses. They both see themselves as specially elected in history with a kind of sense of purpose for humankind. And again, I pose the same question. Is this always going to be a source of confrontation, or could it also be a source of understanding from both sides?
They are both very vibrant societies, because again, one shouldn't assume from the fact that the Chinese regime is an authoritarian regime that you will kind of find in China the societies that you find in other authoritarian regimes. Chinese society has very old commercial trade traditions, entrepreneurial traditions that go back many centuries, and that's still visible. It's a society with a lot of permanent bustle where people wake up with the idea of being a millionaire by the end of the day. And that's kind of similar to America. A second similarity, I think, is that both societies do think of themselves as somehow entitled to rule the world. So the question today is, how can they live together if that's how they see things? Because in the end, the problem is a very simple one. The United States is not receptive to the idea of not being the single superpower. It's very obvious that it cannot live with that idea. And China is not receptive to the idea of being a subordinate power, even if very prosperous, very wealthy, and perhaps even if in the second position of the global ranking, it doesn't want to be in the second position. So how do you solve this? The United States wants to be in the pole position, and China is not happy with being second. That's the problem. It's a very simple one. Now, to go back to the beginning of our conversation, I still don't think that this is a Cold War, because the way I define a Cold War is a conflict where, even though there is no open military conflict, both sides understand that the conflict can only end with the destruction of one of them. It is an existential conflict in that sense. I think that's what characterized the Cold War. between the United States and the Soviet Union. I think that's where the elements that we associate with the Cold War, the system of alliances, the lack of communication between the two spheres in conflict, they come from the fact that it is an existential conflict. After all, if you're struggling for survival and aiming to destroy the other side, you're not going to have students coming from that country to study in your university. That would be ludicrous in a kind of existential conflict. I don't think that's the kind of conflict we have today between America and China. It's still in flux, the situation. It could enter that kind of conflict. Two sides are trying to understand exactly what kind of conflict it is. But right now, I don't see in either the U.S. or China the disposition to see it as a conflict that can only end with the destruction of the other side. I really don't see this in the U.S. or in China. I think both sides are still hoping that the other side can be made to accept a position of some kind of subordination, that China perhaps dreams of a world where the United States becomes rather insular and China can expand its influence all over Eurasia and Africa. But Chinese would not dream about a scenario where they would have to destroy the American regime as it exists today. You don't have that kind of evangelical aspiration. You have an aspiration for power, but not an evangelical aspiration of that kind. And I also don't think the United States would only be happy with the destruction of the Chinese regime or the Chinese economy. I think the United States would be very happy if China went back to the position it had until, let us say, 10 years ago, where it's integrated in American value chains, but in a lower position. America was very happy with that. And I think American decision makers are trying to go back to that world. It seems utopian, but I think that's what they're trying to do. That you negotiate a trade deal where somehow you extract from China the concession that China will no longer aspire to lead some of these global value chains. And then in a case like Huawei, you try to kick a Chinese company out of some of these high value segments of value chains. But if Chinese companies want to be part of American-led value chains producing lower value components, I think Americans would be quite happy with that. So you don't have yet the existential conflict with destruction as the only possible conclusion that I think characterizes a Cold War.
So if you were acting as a prophet rather than as a political scientist or as a commentator, how do you think this rivalry will actually end up resolving itself?
I think we're going to see a continuity of what we've been having. It's going to spread into other areas. What we've been having, limited areas of technology, is going to spread into other areas. It's going to spread into infrastructure, for example, see a global competition to control infrastructure. It's going to spread into cyber conflict. Perhaps it's going to spread into space. But I don't expect economic integration to end. I don't expect the two societies to close themselves to each other. I expect a great game going on for decades, where perhaps some periods will look very successful from an American point of view and other periods more successful from a Chinese point of view. So almost like a game or a sports competition with no end in sight, but where I think the two sides will be very careful never to let things get out of control. They are not interested fundamentally in that. And so far, they don't think that's necessary or inevitable.
Bruno Massaes, thank you very much. That's all we have time for today. In the next episode, I'll be joined by Emma Skye and Robert Fox to talk about state collapse and democracy in the Middle East.